There's a whole lot of things I want to tell you about. Adventures dangerous and queer. Some you could guess, and some I've only hinted at. So please lend me your ear.
Everyone has a relationship with gender. What's your story? Hello and welcome to Gender Stories with your host, Dr. Alexian Taffy.
So welcome to another episode of Gender Stories. I'm your host, Alexian Taffy, and I'm super excited to be talking with Justin Hancock of Bish Training and also the MacJohn and Justin podcast. Amazing madam author. What that means is that Justin also writes with MacJohn Barker, and I also write with MacJohn Barker, so that's kind of where that connection is coming from. I really admire Justin as a sex educator, and the MacJohn and Justin podcast has really inspired me to kind of start my own podcast. So I'm just really super excited to be interviewing Justin today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I can't think of, you know, I've had so many amazing guests. I was like, everybody, I'm always so excited, dear listeners, and it's true.
Well, I love listening to it. I'm a big fan of your podcast. It's really great. I love how you get to it tells so many different gender stories, and you are able to reframe gender in a really warm and inclusive and very diverse way that really includes everyone. So it's thrilled to be involved.
Oh, thank you. So Justin, a lot of your work is really around sex education.
Mm-hmm.
And you're an amazing sex educator based here in London in the UK. And the first question that I have for you really is, tell me a little bit about how you feel sex education intersects with gender. So what's the relationship between sex education and gender in your experience?
I think that it doesn't intersect in the way that I think it probably should. I think, sadly, a lot of sex education, particularly in the UK, is still very much based on kind of very old-fashioned ideas about gender, and that men do this, women do this, and that there is only kind of, it's very straight, it's very aimed at straight kids, yet really lets down a lot of straight kids, whilst simultaneously excluding anyone who isn't straight. And it very much kind of, it perpetuates the ideas of masculinity and femininity, which I think are really unhelpful, particularly around things like consent and things like safer sex. It's always kind of construed as that men are inherently predatory and always trying to get sex and more interested in sex than they are interested in love, and the reverse is true for women, and that women have to kind of repel the advances of men. I think that's sadly kind of a lot of sex education retells those narratives. I mean, where it should be is being much more critical and opening up gender, allowing people to explore their gender in the way that, you know, your podcast and your book you write with MJ does, How to
thank
Understand
you.
Your Gender, plugging it for you. But whilst also recognising the so much sex education doesn't refer to power and doesn't look at the inevitable power imbalances that there are in sexual and romantic relationships, and so we have to be able to kind of open up a space for young people to work out how to do their own gender by doing much more effective sex education, which is more about them rather than about us as educators, and making it much more of a facilitated experience for young people to kind of to go there and figure this out for themselves, and to give them the tools to be able to do that. Whilst also recognising that power and privilege, and how that has a huge impact on how we negotiate relationships, how we negotiate sex, and has a huge, huge impact on consent, and how it's easier for some people to ask for what they want and what they don't want from sex and relationships than others.
So lots of different reasons.
It's pretty basic at the moment still, but I'm trying to change it.
You are doing an amazing job, because even I don't know what happens in the UK, but in the US often, not always, but sometimes people get separated into girls and boys to do sex education, for example. I mean, and which of course is also disastrous for all the non-binary and or trans kids. But even, like you said, even for like the cisgender straight kids, so even those kids who might really fit in to the norms of kind of dominant culture for gender, it's a little bit of a bit of a letdown. What do you think, you know, so talk about power and privilege, like you already said some of the things that you think should be in like really good sex education, but how do you think we can kind of move past this very basic, like perpetuating almost of dominant kind of narratives in sex education? And what can we do differently, I guess, that's what I'm asking.
I think the first thing we need to start doing is to stop making about what we think young people should learn, and to take a completely different approach in the way that we teach. So really to make it more about facilitating really challenging conversations with young, with each other, because most sex education for young people happens outside of the classroom. It happens in the corridor, it happens on social media, it happens at home, it happens in parks, you know, wherever young people hang out, that's where it's all happening. And so like classrooms and or youth group rooms or workshop rooms need to be a space where we give young people the tools to be able to go away and do that effectively and more critically. So I think that's the first thing that we need to do. And I think if we can do that, then we can actually do quite a lot of good. Because one of the issues is that the stuff that we're passing on or trying to pass on is often inherently really heteronormative, really cisnormative, really ableist,
racist,
either racist or kind of being like race, like just being just glossing over it as if race isn't present, you know,
like
isn't
if
an issue.
People don't get sexualized according to their race and ethnicity in lots of ways.
Exactly, and how that and how that can play out, and it's so. And the reason that that stuff is passed on is often that our own sex education has been shit, like really, really bad. And that's the thing. When I train teachers around this, the thing that I ask them to do is to focus on their own sex and relationships education. And for them, usually I would train like up to like 16 people in a room, and there'd be one person who had like pretty okay stuff. They said it wasn't great, it was okay. Everyone else ranged from either it was nothing and didn't exist, or it was terrible, or in some cases traumatic. Like these teachers are still living with the trauma of sex, of their own sex education.
While then trying to educate kids.
Right? So how on earth do we, like, I mean, where do we start? So
this is like breaking the chain of intergenerational cultural trauma around sex education. It
yes.
really is. It's like, that is not a job for the faint-hearted.
No.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things I'm quite, when I'm, I guess I'm one of the more militant sex educators around in the UK, but I really think that bad sex education is worse than no sex education.
Yes, I would agree with that.
I really think that young people are a much better place to work this stuff out for themselves, rather than getting this really bad stuff, the really shaming stuff, the really, the stuff which is kind of scaring young people as well, to scare them off having sex. It's like,
There are some young people who were basically taught if you have sex, you're going to get pregnant, or you're going to get HIV and you're going to die. So literally, like, having sex means getting like a disease, which also is getting misrepresented, and we could talk about HIV stigma or you know. And I even remember growing up, like, my best friend was like, if I got pregnant, and they were a young adult already, so not a minor, like, I would rather have an abortion than tell my parents.
And I
was like, but would you want to have that abortion, or would you just want to avoid this conversation with your parents? And what kind of culture do we live in if we feel like, you know, and often that gets perpetuated, right? That it's only like dads talk to boys about sex, and moms talk to girls about sex, and they're passing on their trauma and gendered relationship in this cisnormative, heteronormative way a lot of the time. And so do teachers, and so we're kind of passing on this relational trauma through and call it sex education.
And I think it's done in a way to kind of close down conversations rather than to open them up, and that's the issue that we I think the scary thing that a lot of adults think is that we don't want to reveal to young people that we don't have our shit sorted about sex and relationships. And I say this all the time. Like, I say it on my blog posts at bishuk.com. I say it in my work with MJ and our podcast, and I say it throughout my resources. Like, I'm 42. I teach this. Right. I've been doing sex and relationships education since 1999, so a long time. And I, you know, struggle with this stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. And kind of adults, in inverted commas, are like trying to perpetuate this idea that they've got it all sorted to young people in order to close the conversation down. So really good sex education, good conversations about sex and relationships are a facilitated, like, collaborative approach. Mm. So if for parents, I always say that it's okay to find out stuff together and to chat about stuff together and to chat about things happening in the news and the media without having to talk about ourselves, and to keep it normalized and to keep it like a part of the conversation, and to know that this is ground that can be covered and can be talked about in a way which isn't kind of, I know everything about this and I'm going to teach you all the key messages you need to learn, which is just bollocks.
It really is. And it's like there's often this dilemma, right, of what is age appropriate information when doing sex education, right? And what fascinates me also is that often what's considered age appropriate changes from gender to gender, in kind of dominant culture, right? So what is considered age appropriate for whom, when, how does gender impact that? Of course, how does kind of race, ethnicity, and class impact that? Because I think those are all factors, right? The environment and our identities and experiences. But if you do that collaborative, if you take that collaborative approach, then in some ways you're also willing to listen to where the young people are at.
Absolutely.
And often that surprises parents. Like, people think that, you know, sex education needs to happen in middle school or even high school. And my experience is that that point is so late. Like, young people are not really willing, definitely not willing to listen to their parents if they haven't started to talk to them at a much younger age. And I think there was some research in the US that even showed that, like, 11 years old is the average age at which sometimes young people come across porn online for the first time. I remember my kid telling me, you have no idea what gets talked about in middle school. There's so much misinformation that goes around, starting from around second, third grade, in my experience, both as a parent and family therapist. And yet we often tag on sex education somewhere between the ages of like 12 and 16, if we're lucky.
I mean, the thing is that, yes, it has to happen. Relationships and sex education has to happen throughout the life cycle, I think. And age appropriateness is, I think, quite straightforward to get. If the young people are getting it, then it's appropriate. If they're not getting it, then it's, what are you talking about, Justin? And I've been in, and the difficulty for sex education in schools is young people's sexual development and sexual knowledge is so varied.
Like, absolutely.
So I often get, so one of my resources is called Planet Porn, and I often get people buying my resource and wanting to use it with years 8, year 9 or something, which is under the recommended age, I say, to use Planet Porn. So year 8, year 9 here is that's between like 12 and 14. And I wrote that resource really for over 14 year olds and maybe even a bit older. And because teachers often have this idea that all young people are looking at porn, and actually the most recent UK research demonstrates that 75% of 15 and 16 year olds haven't seen any sexual images at all, and that half of those that have saw them on the telly, things like Game of Thrones or something. So there might be some young people who are looking at porn at the age of 11 and like actively going to porn, and others for whom like that's just not on their radar at all.
And what's interesting to me as well is, like, who are they talking to? Because often what I'm finding is the assumption is that boys are looking at porn and girls are not, right? And the girls need to be talked about not getting pregnant. And often that's also what I found, that both parents and sex educators are more worried about girls, again, in air quotes, because they're like, you know, people can get pregnant getting pregnant, rather than looking at kind of power dynamics or avoiding abusive relationships for people of all genders. So there's this weird way in which sometimes different people get different bits because of their sex assigned at birth.
Yeah.
Sex education. Does that, am I making sense? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. And I think there are also some, I think a lot of the differences around how sex and relationships education is delivered is because of the, is because it's due to classroom management issues. Mm. Like, it's thought that the lads take up too much space, the girls don't get enough time. And the problem is that there isn't enough of it in the curriculum to get it right for everybody. And also, it's not collaborative enough. It's not asking the young people what they want, and it's not working with them. It's not facilitating conversations. It's telling people how to think. So it's kind of, it's the, if we got the methods right and the approach right about how we're meant to teach it, then we'd overcome a lot of those difficulties, and also make the spaces much themselves model the kinds of diversity and inclusion that we want to have. But there are these huge assumptions made based around gender in terms of what it is that young people are interested in. And I've worked a lot with lads, so I've mostly worked with lads over the years, and they are really, really interested in talking about love.
Yes.
Like, really. Really
into
talking
it. About love and relationship and intimacy in my experience. That's true. Yeah.
And they're also quite chill with talking with each other about it as well. I mean, there are an awful lot of misnomers about this. Mm-hmm. And they are, I was going to say thirsty, but that has like a different connotation now, doesn't it? Thirsty. They are hungry to talk about. They're hungry in when I'm working with, when they're working with me, we're working together, that they're asking me about this stuff all the time. So yeah, those kinds of, because we're not starting with the young people and we're not working with them collaboratively, we're not finding that out.
Yeah, and yeah, it was interesting. Even, and I think that goes across the lifespan when I was doing this research around aging and sexuality. We decided to have mixed gender focus groups, and there were some really moving moments about people really talking about their experiences and also being accountable. Right, when men saying to some of the women in the room, like, when I hear you talk about that, it really brings up all those feelings for me about how I was raised or I was taught, and now I would teach my grandchildren something different, right? Then in some ways, it's this weird thing where sex education is almost like shaping people to enact those kind of gendered stereotypes where actually maybe their inner desire is quite in a different place. Like, I think that we are all wired for connection, and boys also need that sense of connection and belonging and want to know how to do relationships. And often that's, you know, they're not really getting access to the information they need to become skilled at it.
No. And the messages that they receive are that they, that, you know, men are meant to be active, meant to be actively pursuing relationships, and that they have to do a particular kind of masculinity in order to do that. So they also have concerns about that.
Right.
And are also interested, increasingly interested, in different kinds of gender as well. I started wearing nail polish over the last couple of years, mainly to cover it. I've got psoriasis in my nails, and I thought, well, instead of like constantly trying to treat it, I'm going to just paint over it.
Great idea.
And so this has like an effect when I'm teaching in a school, particularly with boys. They kind of start to think, oh, well, maybe I can start asking gender questions, and I can start to ask about non-binary, and ask about pronouns, and it, I don't know whether the two are related, because actually it's also just more in the conversation now as well on social media and in the news, but they can feel that they can kind of go there as well and talk about this stuff. So I'm hoping that that will also get them. What we also need in, and how I got into sex education actually, was doing work with young men around masculinities and trying to really explore the rules that we get around being a man and how narrow they are and the repercussions that you face if you don't conform to those, and how, what a scary place that can be if you don't conform to the rules of masculinity. So that has to be kind of thrown into the mix here as well, that, you know, that, that first of all, sex education has to not retell those stories about masculinity, but also allow us to challenge them and allow us to model different kinds of masculinity, I think, as well.
And I think that's, when we were talking about, you know, the podcast and what I wanted to ask you about, one of the questions I mentioned was that I really wanted to ask you about how your own identity kind of impacts your work as a sex educator. Mm. So, you know, your gender identity, but and of course you can talk about any other aspects of your identity that you think impacts the way
yeah.
you interact with young people and teachers when you kind of do the training, the trainer
yeah.
kind of types of event. But, yeah.
I mean, I kind of, when I first started working in this field back in the day, I got into it through youth work, and it was mm-hmm. seen as an advantage that if I was going to be doing work around masculinities, but also then sex and relationships education primarily with young men, which is how yeah. I first got into it, that it was a benefit that I was a man. And actually, when I was starting out, I found that a real disbenefit. I found mm-hmm. that really, really tricky, because men talking to other men about sex was, you know, a difficult thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think they kind of thought that I'd be able to get through to young men and find these, like, in inverted commas, hard to reach young men
mm-hmm.
by being a man and knowing, and kind of, I don't know, having like the sense that I must know everything about them because of my masculinity, because I have
like
a very
magical tune in.
Exactly. And the thing is, I have a very different masculinity to all the young men that I was working with, and so mm-hmm. it didn't really make any sense. So how I approached it was, I'm going to try and be the very best youth worker, which I how I got into this. I'm going to try and be as professional and as person-centered and as reflective of my own practice as yeah. I can. I'll use that instead, and that seemed to be that seems to work much better.
What is it that you felt was different by your masculinity? Was it like the way you were doing masculinity? Was it an age gap? Because, you know, I was a youth worker too.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's something about generational gap, right? Even yeah. when I was in my early 20s, I was working with teenagers. So,
yeah.
you know, years have passed and different references and all of that. But,
well, yeah. there were lots of differences in, depending on the kinds of groups of young men that I was working with at the time. So, and the groups that I found most difficult to work with were those that biographically were seen, were closest to who I was. So, I'm from Derby, which is like a small city in the North Midlands, and I was from a very particular bit of Derby, which is very, very white, working class kind of area. And it was with the white working class boys from the area I was brought up in, the West End, that I had the most difficulty working with. And they were like, "Who the fuck are you?" kind
what
of thing.
What was that about?
Well,
so you shared identities.
Yeah.
But there was something that didn't connect.
They just really, like, they really loathed me. I don't know whether it was, I don't even really know why. I know that when I started working with different groups, so in the one of the big projects I worked on in Derby was with young South Asian kids, mostly mm-hmm. Pakistani background, like the grandparents were probably, I think, Pakistani and Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's super challenging work for lots of different reasons. And I was on like a steep learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like the most innovative, successful youth work that I was doing. And I had the most connections there. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I guess there was a benefit to being somebody who is not read as being from your community doing work with you, and somebody demonstrating empathy because they're doing that from, because it's their job to do it, and mm-hmm. to come along and to be as good at their job as they are, and to value those young people for who they are, rather than, I guess, that kind of maybe being perceived to be like somebody's uncle or older brother or, you know, someone in it trying to, you know, that, yeah. I guess there was something going on there. But
that's fascinating, because I wonder if also with those boys who had like similar background to yours, if there was an element, if there was that element of seeing you as like the older brother or the parent, you know, like somebody, like one of the men in their
yeah.
life, and having certain, and if they felt they had to perform masculinity in a certain way.
Yeah.
So who knows whether they liked you or not, but if part of their performing masculinity was to be like dismissive and difficult and challenging
yeah.
and rude when talking about sex, that they were actually like just performing what maybe they thought you expected outside of a professional role.
Yeah, I think that's probably a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And it's that the me coming along of being somebody from that bit of Derby with like, yeah, those expectations culturally, in like this very
mm-hmm.
small culture that this is, yeah, came with it all this baggage that they were, yeah, reacting mm-hmm. against, perhaps.
Yeah.
But it's, I think that's my relationship to this is that clearly I am a bloke. I'm
mm-hmm.
cis. I don't usually tell people that I'm straight, but I'm also straight. So there is a kind of, I have to kind of almost work with that rather than work that. I kind of have to kind of work alongside that. I can't escape how I present to the world, and I can't escape how people are reading me. But the way that I try to work is to do this kind of more collaborative and very kind, very non-hierarchical kind of work, which means that I have to almost like disown elements of this kind of potentially quite an authoritative kind of figure that I could be read as, if that makes sense. Yeah. So to disown a bit of that, I guess I dissemble a lot. I'm often quite scruffy. I'm a kind of call me Justin kind of sex educator, and I kind of disarm myself a lot and try to take a lot of that perceived power away, and I kind of mumble and I sometimes accidentally swear in class, and you know, it's like I have to kind of do a lot of that work in order to really to work effectively with lads in particular, because there is so much potential performance of masculinity going on that I think that as soon as you can start to really dial that back, then you can get beyond that and actually really get to a place where people are more able to feel vulnerable and more able to talk about actually the stuff that they want this lesson to do for them.
So it sounds like there's a lot of intention about how do you present yourself.
Yeah.
With young people, not in a inauthentic way, because I feel like you're quite authentic.
Yeah.
But you know, in actually a really vulnerable way, which in some ways often vulnerability is equated more with femininity than with masculinity. So presenting in this kind of very kind of vulnerable, open, not you know way. But then as you were talking about that, this is where my brain is going. I don't know if it'll make any sense to you. As you were talking about that, I was thinking about what would happen if somebody who wasn't your gender was doing those things, and that might be read quite as unprofessional. So there's almost this like double-edged sword or this paradox that you're doing those things so that young people can relate, but in some ways you can do those things because of your identity is kind of that is not necessarily seen as unprofessional, that is seen as like you're being laid back and connecting, and I might imagine either a trans and non-binary person or even a cis woman kind of presenting in similar ways and maybe seen as unprofessional or offensive or does that make sense? Because that's often been my experience, that sometimes cis men can do things that other people of other genders are not allowed, in kind of air quotes, inverted commas, to do. So it's like this weird paradox. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I guess what we're talking about is that is the power and privilege issue. I'm coming into a classroom, and I've got many layers of power and privilege. So I'm the oldest person there, and I'm the one near the PowerPoint screen, which I really try not to use. You know, I'm at the front of the class, so, and they're in their school uniform or something, and I don't have very long use typically, and I have like one or two lessons, so there I'm being read as being powerful, and then I have to undercut it in order to present a lesson which is non-hierarchical, whilst also maintaining my expertise.
Yeah,
just tricky. It's a hard. It's a dance, but then I guess with somebody of a different gender, the power and the privilege of being a cis man is absent, so they'd have to navigate that in a different way. But I guess the thing for me is really the point I'm trying to get to, I suppose, is that my training as a youth worker and in being a good sex and relationships educator is much more valuable to me than anything to do with gender.
Absolutely.
I think sometimes and I can't disentangle that from my gender. It's a big part of why I'm a gentle person, and why I'm trying to be a kind person, whilst also being quite cross at the state of sex and relationships education and youth services and sexual services. But I guess you can't have one without the other, but for me, I really try to amplify the professionalism of being a good sex and relationships educator, because the problem is that we've been deprofessionalized so much. There are so few sex and relationships educators. There's no proper training really in the That's UK. Mm-hmm. It's kind of shocking. Yeah. We don't really have any quality standards even. There's no governing body for us. Yeah. So if we're just kind of kind blokes turning up in classrooms, that's kind of like not enough, you know. We need this other stuff.
It's quite the dance then, right? Because you're there basically almost doing this disassembly of like this power and privilege to connect with young people, while being very aware that you can do that because of your power and privilege.
Yeah,
you know. And it's like this weird dance, like, and also the reason why you can even do that dance is because you're an incredibly effective and experienced and well-educated sex educator who's done a lot of work in this area. You know, you've been doing this for almost 20 years now. And I wondered, like, what kind of changes have you seen in that time? It's like, this is two decades, right?
Yeah.
So you've gotten really good at that during that time, but there've also been a lot of changes kind of in the environment and kind of around you. And I would guess also changes in how you see yourself. Like, this has been part of your development in some way, in terms of your identity.
Exactly. I mean, I'm a much better sex educator. I really would not like to go back to see some of my...
Well, that's how I feel about being a therapist. I'm better now than I was 10 years ago. I think that's a good thing. Sorry about my clients 10 years ago, that I wasn't as good as I am now.
I mean, that's definitely the thing. I think that it's hard to tell whether I've got better because I'm a better sex educator, we're having more nuanced, more challenging conversations, that we're getting to more difficult topics more quickly. Maybe it's partly that I'm just better at getting to that place, or whether the young people that I'm working with are moving on politically. I think it's probably definitely a combination of both of those things. Mm-hmm. And young people are more politically aware now than they were. Certainly, I no longer have, like, in terms of what young men say to me around how they want to have sex, though, I used to have young men say, you know, I don't care if the other person's enjoying it or not, as long as I'm enjoying it. Mm. And now it's moved much more to, I want them to enjoy it more than I'm enjoying it, and to, like, do this performance of sex and to do sex well, which is, both of those are problematic in different ways.
Absolutely.
In similar ways. So that's kind of changed. Maybe porn has had like a subtle influence there, but the influence that porn has is often really overstated and is oversimplified. I think it's very there's lots of different things going on there, which I probably won't go into because I go off on a tangent, and I think it's so overstated that it's not.
We'll have to do all other episodes about that.
I think so. So I think that's. But in terms of how I've changed, I mean, I've always. When I got trained as a youth worker, I was really lucky that I got some excellent training paid for by the state, which taught me about anti-oppressive practice and being person-centred and being a reflective practitioner. And that's incredibly valuable training. And it's the kind of thing that it's training that I always use. And I always go back to it, and I always think about it, and I'm always like, I've always been a work in progress around trying to do that stuff and trying to be to incorporate that stuff in all of my work wherever I'm doing it. So I guess that's kind of gone with me. And also, I guess over the last few years, the way that I've started doing relationships and sex differently and trying to be more critical over that kind of stuff, and certainly the work that I do with MJ for our writing and also for our podcast, that kind of the way that we're both able to draw on our own experiences as well as the experiences of working with other people and other adults and young people together, and the experiences of our own relationships is super valuable. So that kind of being able to have like that increased capacity to be able to do that kind of work, and all the therapy really helped. You know, it's like, I guess it's that thing of, you know, being an adult, I suppose. I mean, I started working with young people when I was 18, really, my first youth work job. Yeah. So I've been doing it over. So I would have been a rubbish youth worker as an 18-year-old, but as a 42-year-old doing sex education, sex and relationships education stuff, but that's an obvious thing to say, isn't it?
Well, but sometimes the obvious things are really important too, right? Because that's part of being a reflecting practitioner. There are practitioners without change of practices very much. And so, you know, the beauty of that being a reflective practitioner is that you really... learn that, yes, this is what, you know, what am I doing and what could I change? And then as you change it, you kind of revisit that again,
absolutely.
Right? Absolutely. So it seems obvious, but it's also true.
Absolutely. I mean, that's some of the most valuable things that I've ever learned have been from the people that I'm ostensibly there to teach, in inverted commas. You know, the way that they have so there was one good example of this. I've been delivering workshops around consent using the metaphor and analogy / experiential learning method of doing handshakes. And I ask young people to do a handshake for the first handshake, and then to negotiate a handshake for the second handshake, and then for the third one to really tune into the handshake and have like a more mindful and ongoing consensual handshake where it's more mutual and collaborative.
Yeah.
But... a couple of lads were saying when they were asked to negotiate their second handshake, they said, "Oh, that was terrible." And it's like, okay, that's cool. It's allowed to be terrible. They said it because we talked about everything we wanted to do. It raised the bar so much that we knew we were going to be disappointed. And I was like, what a brilliant way of thinking about it. So we kind of like spent the whole rest of the lesson thinking about that. It just never occurred to me before that we could negotiate sex to the point at which then, after that, we will fear that the sex will be nowhere near as good as that, or we might do something non-consensual because we've talked about everything, but we might forget something, or we might get something wrong.
We might get so much in our heads about it, but then where's the body in the moment, right?
Exactly.
I'm hearing in some ways when they're saying
So, yeah, I learned that from a 16-year-old about 4 years ago, and I was like, well, okay. Thank you for that. And I said, you know, that was super important. He was like, yeah, chill, whatever. And
it was super
important, right? I know. So I wish more people were doing that reflective stuff and learning from the people that they're working with.
Yeah. I could just keep talking about this forever. I have like another 15 questions in my head, but I think I'm going to change them for the next time I interview you. Because I definitely know there's going to be a second part, but... for this episode, I wonder if there's anything in this initial conversation that we're having that I haven't asked you about that you're like, oh, I wish you'd really ask me about this. I really wanted to talk about this. Mm. Or not. I mean, there may or may not be.
I mean, I guess one thing, just thinking about the benefits of masculine, of being a bloke, a cis bloke, is that it's easier for me to call people out on this, or to not call people out, but to challenge people gently and to
I love that reframe that you just did.
And also it's easier for me to so when young people write to me via my website, which is the main work I do now, bishuk.com, it's mostly read by young men, but young women read it too. And when young people ask me a question, if it's another guy and he's done something shitty, I can use my position as a bloke to say, hey, this thing you did is really shit. Yeah. However, I'm also going to be like gentle and nice and give you some good advice here, but this thing right here is no good. No. That is like something that being a bloke gives me. And it's important to do it, obviously, but it makes me more heard and gives me a bit more class, I think.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's that intentional way of using your power and privilege, rather than just like wielding it unintentionally over the face. It's like really being aware of it, being conscious of it and using it for the benefit of the people you serve.
Yeah,
that's what I'm hearing in that. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's definitely my experience of you, that you're like very kind, very intentional, but also really authentic and real, and like really aware of kind of your position in the world, and that's what you bring to your work.
Yeah.
You know, including your awareness of your own masculinity and what that means.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hope so.
Well, I think so. Thank you so much. I'm so excited. Like I said, I have like another 20 questions that I'm going to kind of go and write down for the next time that we get to be in a room together talking. But for now, I know you mentioned kind of your book and your resources, but I would love for you to really like talk about where can people find you, all the different websites, the social media, your book. This is your time to let the listeners know. I will also put in the episode description, but I would love for them to hear it as well.
Okay, so this is going to take a while. So
You've
done a lot of amazing stuff, that's why. I've got one website which has a list of everything, which is justinhancock.co.uk, if you forget all of this. So I've got bishuk.com, which is my sex and relationships and other lots of other stuff, advice website for over 14s, and that's sponsored by Jurex UK, and it's that's my main job. I've got bishtraining.com, which is my website for practitioners who are doing sex and relationships education work. So I've got resources on there for people to buy and download, but also people see details of my training courses and project work that I do. I've got another website called dosreforschools.com, which is a big project I've been working on, again sponsored by Jurex, but in collaboration with the leading sex and relationships education agencies in the UK, which is about trying to get better, more inclusive, more about the young people, more everything I've been talking about in this podcast out there in schools. And it's a free resource for teachers in the UK, but worldwide. And the other one, of course, is megjohnandjustin.com, where you can see all my work with MJ, our podcasts, our book, Enjoy Sex, How, When, and If You Want To, a practical and inclusive guide. Ooh, that's a long title.
It's a really great book. Like, if you really want the best sex education book for, like, I think it's just such a great book. And it is available in the UK and the US. It's available on Kindle. It's available as a paperback. It's probably the best money you'll ever spend if you're going to buy a sex advice book. That's what I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, what's the title again?
Enjoy Sex, How, When, and If You Want To. And that's for, it's for sex advice book for adults, but there's nothing in there that would be inappropriate for younger folk, but it's aimed at over 18s, really.
Yes.
I think that's all the work I do. I've probably missed something out. I always do.
You probably have, but then we can add it to the episode description. But you do a lot of amazing stuff. So thank you so much for coming on my tiny baby podcast, which is just beginning, and being a guest on my podcast. And I can't wait to interview you again.
Cool. Well, I love it very much. I learned so much from it. So thanks very much for doing it.
Well, dear listeners, that's the end of another episode. Please keep listening to Gender Stories. Find us on your favorite platform. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and also listen to the Meg, John, and Justin podcast and find them everywhere on social media. And I think they're also on Instagram now, too. Or not.
Maybe no, not Facebook. Yet.
Not yet. Maybe next. And in the meantime, have wonderful, enjoyable sex if, when, and how you want to. And if you don't want to, that's cool, too.
Yep.
And I will see you at the next episode. Thank you.